Osho.
Tao, the Pathless Path, Volume 2. Talks on extracts from the Lita Zoo, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 14.
The first question. You say you can also become a great heart, even though I am 26, I am seeking. Am I not trying to become a good heart? Can one become a great heart by seeking? Never, never one can become a great heart by seeking. Seeking is the only barrier in realizing your greatness. The very idea of seeking puts you away from yourself. Seeking means seeking somewhere else. Seeking means seeking outside. Seeking means you are looking everywhere else except your own being. Non-seeking means not looking anywhere, just being centered in your being, just being there. When you are not seeking, you are in your own being. In that very moment, you are a great heart. Everybody is a great heart. The good ones and the bad ones too. The bad ones have gone seeking on the bad lines, and the good ones have gone seeking on the good lines. The bad ones have become criminals, immoral, and the good ones have become moral, saintly. But both are seeking. Both are always on the way. There is a goal in their life. And they are rushing away from themselves. Everybody is a born great heart. When you are tired of your seeking, frustrated, you drop all seeking of being good, of being bad. You just close your eyes and it is there. The great heart is there. It has been always there. It is your nature. Nobody is born who is not great. Nothing else ever happens in this existence except then greatness. Because it is out of God. How you cannot be great? You are great. Greatness is not something that you have to cultivate. A cultivated greatness will not be real greatness. Deep down you will know you are not great. Deep down you know you have practiced it. Deep down you know that it is just on the surface a mask, pretending that you are Alexander, pretending that you are Christ, pretending that you are a Buddha, pretending this and that. You can pretend and you can deceive the whole world, but how can you deceive yourself? You will always know who you are. You may be pretending bravery and deep down the coward. You have hidden your cowardness by painting bravery on top of it. You may be smiling, but hidden behind are tears. How can you deceive yourself? So the first thing to remember, never by seeking anybody has come home. Seeking means going astray. Only non-seekers come. But to become a non-seeker, first one has to become a seeker. Seeking is part of attaining non-seeking. Even a Buddha has to seek and go astray and suffer. That pain is a must. That is the price we pay. Then one day when you have sought every direction, every dimension, and never anywhere you have found anything that you wanted, when your frustration is utterly total, in that very moment of frustration, all seeking drops. Suddenly, you are back home. But to come home, one has to knock on many doors. So I am not saying that drop your seeking if you are still not utterly confused, utterly frustrated. If you are still hankering, if there is still hope lurking somewhere in your mind that you can find by seeking, then seek, seek by all means. Although, by seeking nobody has ever attained. But I will say seek, seek by all means, so that you can be frustrated, so that you can recognize the hopelessness of the very effort. In that hopelessness is hope. In that frustration dawns a totally new existence, the world of being. Seeking is the world of beginning. To me, you are already great horses. I have never come across anybody who is not a great horse. He may be thinking he is not. That is his problem. He may be thinking or even believing that he is not. And people behave according to their belief. If you believe you are not a great horse, you will behave in a way that suits to one who is not a great horse. If you believe you are bad, you will behave that way. If you believe you are good, you will behave that way. But your pretensions are your pretensions. Your actings. I see your original face. I see you as you are. The day I have seen my own great heart, that very day, all other horses have disappeared for me. I look into every face, into every eyes, and the great horse is there. It is the same horse that exists in me, that exists in you. There are not two horses. It is the same greatness. It is the same ocean that waves in you and that waves in me, that waves in a Buddha, in a Christ, in a Krishna. But when you are seeking, you cannot look inside yourself. Seeking means you have moved into the future. Seeking means you have already gone to the goal. Seeking means you have already reached where you believe you have to be. It is a projection. It is a fantasy trip. It is a mind journey. Non-seeking means mind has stopped. Non-seeking means there is no movement inside you. You are not going anywhere. Sitting silently, doing nothing. The spring comes and the grass grows by itself. The second question. If groups are a safer and more stimulating place to begin to expand any conceivable personal boundaries, why have you not encouraged the creation of Indian groups with Indian leaders? This foolish question comes again and again, so it is better to be finished with it. First thing, the East has developed a totally different kind of psychology than the West. Their needs are different. They need different medicines. In the West, the psychology that has grown down the ages is extrovert. It is outgoing. The psychology that has been developed in the East is introvert. It is ingoing. For a real Eastern person, growth groups are not needed. He needs meditations like vipassana, zazen, in which he can forget the whole outside world and just drown into his own being. He does not need any relationship. Relating is not needed. He needs only to unrelate himself from the world, to be in a state of total, utter aloneness. Deep solitude is needed. Down the centuries, the East has developed introversion. It is very natural for the real Eastern. I am saying real Eastern because now it is very difficult to find a real Eastern person. West has contaminated everybody. The Western education, or the Western victory, the Western victory over nature, the Western domination of the East has contaminated everybody. Otherwise, the Eastern mind is not in any need to do any growth group. The growth group is needed because you have a tremendous need to relate, to love, to communicate. In the West, the basic problem is how to communicate, how to relate. So many Westerners are here. When they come to me in darshan, their problem are 100% of relationship. How to relate? Not even a single Indian ever comes who says how to relate. That is not the problem at all. He says how to be silent. How to be into one's own being. His question is how to drop out of relationship. He wants to be non-attached. He wants to break all the bridges that exist. He wants how to live in the world and yet live in such a way that one does not live there. One is far away in the Himalayas. Even if one has to live in the world, one wants to live in the Himalayas, at least spiritually, inwardly. Not a single Indian comes who says, this is my problem, how to relate with my wife, how to relate with my son, how to relate with my mother, how to relate with my friend. A relationship is a question of group dynamics. He asks how not to relate, how to forget my wife, how to forget my children, how to forget my job, how to be just alone in my inner being. Crystal, pure, clean, non-reflecting anybody, not even a shadow moves there. This is a different psychology. Both are the ways to reach the ultimate. One is meditation, another is love. The East has developed the mind for meditation, the West has developed the mind for love. Love means relationship, meditation means non-relationship. That's why I am not sending Easterners except Japanese. Few Japanese I have been sending because Japan is the most western part of the East. Indians only once or twice I have sinned. Those were only for the name's sake Indians. They are born in the East, but their mind is not developed by the Eastern concept. Their mind is Western. They have been taught by Christian missionaries in Christian schools. Their whole education and bringing up is Western. This is the first thing to understand. West will easily move through love. And through love will come to oneself. It is a longer way. Meditation is a shortcut. Love means I go into the other, look my face into the eyes of the other, encounter the other, and in encountering the other, I come to know about myself, and then I come back. It is via the other. But I come back to myself. Love also comes to the inner solitude, but it has a long way. It goes through the other. It is a big circle. Meditation is a short way, reduced to the minimum. You don't go to the other, you simply close your eyes and you drown yourself into yourself. You drop into your own being. Both are perfectly right. It depends on the person, what he needs. Too few Westerners also I don't suggest. When I see some Westerner who has no need to relate, then I don't suggest. Then I say there is no need. But at least 5,000 years of different psychological conditioning exists that has to be taken note of. I cannot say the Eastern and the Western are just the same. They are not. At the innermost core they are. In their being they are. But in their minds they are not. Their approach is different. They need different methodology. If a Westerner comes and I put him directly into Vipassana-like methods, he is simply at a loss. He cannot understand what is happening. It is a torture. He feels simply as if he is a masochist. So why he is torturing himself? Why sitting in a siddhasana, in a Buddha posture, with closed eyes? For what? The Western mind wants to move, relate, dance, sing, celebrate. The Western mind is dynamic. It wants some process. Step by step it can go into it. One day it has to come to a silent meditative state. But one has to go first through growth groups, then it becomes very easier. The Eastern person, if he is sent to a growth group, will be simply at a loss. Even Japanese are at a loss. There have been questions from Japanese that, Bhagwan, why you send us? You don't send Indians. Why you send us to the growth groups? They don't feel good. They feel very much worried. It is very difficult for them to relate the way a Western person can relate. They are not open that way. And they don't see the point of it. They don't see the point why go into it. When you know a shortcut, then why go the long way? And the East has known the shortcut always. But in the West, it has been different. There is a question. What is the difference between an enlightened person, a master, and a messiah? it is relevant to this question too. An enlightened person is one who has come home, for whom all problems have disappeared, who has no problems to solve, who has just to live, whose life is no more burdened by any question, whose life is absolutely weightless. But every enlightened person is not necessarily a master. Out of 100 enlightened persons, at least, at the most, one or two will become masters. An enlightened person is one who has come home. The master is one who has compassion for others and would like to help others. But the master is interested only into individual others. He relates with individuals. One here, one there. He has no idea of the society. Then he is a master. A messiah is one who has compassion for the whole society and who is not worried about individuals but takes the whole society as one unit. In the East, enlightened people have existed and masters have existed, but never a messiah. The messiah is not an Eastern concept at all. Buddha is not a messiah. Neither is Mahavir, nor is Krishna. They are masters, perfect masters. But their approach is to the individual, direct, personal. Jesus is a messiah. So is Moses. So is Muhammad. Their approach is not individual. Their approach is social, communal. They are interested to change the whole lot of humanity. Judaism, Christianity, Islam are all messianic. Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism are non-messianic. All the Eastern, basic Eastern religions say that the society does not exist. Only the individual exists. And all the Western religions say, in fact, individual is just a part of the society. The real thing is the society, the group. The group exists, not the individual. The individual exists in the group. Both are right in a way, because both are half right. Individual and society both exist. Neither the individual can exist without the society, nor the society can exist without the individual. Can you conceive a society where no individual exists? Then there will be no society at all. Can you conceive an individual who exists without the society? Then there will be no individual at all. Even an individual who exists in the Himalayas alone, even he exists in the society. He was born to a mother. He was brought up by a father. He lived in a society. Even the idea that one has to go to the Himalayas was given by a particular society, that one has to renounce all. Now sitting there in the Himalayas, what he is doing? He must be meditating. That meditation was given by Patanjali or Buddha. What he will be doing? He will be thinking of God, contemplating that God comes from the society. And in the deepest core of his being, he knows that the society exists. If suddenly he comes to know that the society that he had left one day has disappeared completely from the earth, he will be shocked. He will be shaken. He will start trembling, perspiring. He will run back to the plains to see what has happened to the society. Although he was living alone, but in a subtle way, he was part of the society still. No individual can exist without society. no society can exist without individuals. So both are true, but the approaches are different. Jesus says the whole society can attain to salvation if people want to move in groups, communes, they can attain to salvation. Buddha will say that is not possible. Each has to move alone. Each has to move on his own. Each has to reach God solitary. No group can move. Hence, out of Christianity have come all sorts of social philosophies. In the East, no social philosophy has been yet given birth. Communism is out of Christianity. It is the same messianic idea. Although communism says there is no God and religion is the opium of the people, still it is growth of the same idea that the society is important. And the society can attain to a higher state. The individual is irrelevant. Fascism or other ideologies, socialism, democracy, they are all born in the West. They are all part of the same Masonic ideal. The Messiah is a Western idea. The society can have a salvation. The group can become enlightened as a group. In the East, masters have existed, but no Messiah. That's why Jesus has a little tinge of politics in his utterances. Maybe that's why he is crucified. Buddha was never crucified, because the society was never much in trouble with him. He was not talking about the society at all. He was talking about individuals. You can go on changing individuals. The society can rest. Nothing is to be worried. But when a person says, I am going to change the whole society, then there is fear. Maybe that is the reason why Socrates is poisoned, Mansur is killed, Jesus is crucified. No Buddha, no Mahavir, no Krishna have been killed, crucified, poisoned. Why? There must be some reason. They were very dangerous people, more dangerous than Jesus. At least as much dangerous as Jesus. But their approach was individual. The society does not bother about individuals. If one individual becomes a meditator, it doesn't change the whole society. It is almost as if a drop of water is changed in the whole ocean. Who bothers? But Jesus has a program to color the whole ocean. Then the priest, the politician, they all become afraid. Their investment is at stake. And they are being thrown. They are being dethroned. They are being uprooted. The Messiah has naturally something to do with politics. The Master has nothing to do with politics. That becomes a problem. Christian missionaries used to come to me and they will say, it is good to help people to meditate, but what about society? What are you doing for the society? People are hungry, starving, ill. Why don't you think about making more hospitals, schools? Why don't you help people to help others? Just meditating. Yes, it is good. A person becomes silent. But is it enough? I can understand why they are asking the question. The question comes from the Masonic idea, the Messiah. A master has to be a Messiah. In the East, no. In the East, a master is simply a master. His approach is individual. His approach is meditative rather than political, personal rather than social. the East has a different psychology. The West has a different psychology. This has to be understood once for all. If groups are a safer and more stimulating place to begin to expand any conceivable personal boundaries, why have you not encouraged the creation of Indian groups with Indian leaders? That will not be possible. Even if I have to create a group for Indians, the leaders will be Western. First, it will be difficult to find Indian participants. If I can manage, because few people are there who are no more Eastern, are only so-so, then too, the group leader has to be Western. It will be very difficult to find the Eastern group leader. He will not have the very idea of it. He will not have the nuance of it. He will not have the real spirit of it. Yes, he can run a group. Mechanical it will be. He will not be a Tirtha, and he will not be a Sumindra, and he will not be a Divya. He will not have the insight. He will not be Amitabh. He will not be Anam. No, he will lack the insights. Those insights take centuries to develop. He will be doing something and he will do it. It is happening in other fields also. The scientist is basically the Western byproduct. Indian scientists are there. Even one or two have got Nobel Prizes too. But still, I never come across a real scientist in the East. Never. The mind is not scientific. They learn. They put their intelligence to it. They learn all that can be learned. But the spirit is lacking. If you look into their personal life, you will not find them scientific. Their approach will be non-scientific. When they are in their lab, they may become scientific. But when you go into their house, you will find them doing puja, worshipping a statue, or doing a mantra, and crying. In the lab, they may be objective, but when they are in their home, they are no more objective at all. There they will be superstitious as any ordinary person. They may even go and follow Satya Sai Baba. There are people. And they will think miracles are possible. Now this is very unscientific. A scientist cannot believe that miracles are possible. No miracles are possible. That is a fundamental law of science. Everything is according to the law. Miracle means something which is not according to the law. How a miracle is possible? Miracle means something is happening which should not happen. Science cannot trust it. If it is happening, then there must be either it is according to the law and we have not discovered the law, then too it is not miracle. Or there is some magic, some trick, some sleight of hand. It is simple for the scientific mind, it is simple. But you can find scientists following Satya Sai Baba and believing that things are appearing out of nothingness. Their mind is not scientific. Their mind is centuries old and the scientific layer is very thin. They have gone to the West, they have been to the Oxford, to the Cambridge, they have learned everything. They are intelligent people, but not scientific. They may have even discovered something. They may have been given a Nobel Prize, but still they are not scientific. At the most, they are technical. They know the technique. But if you look deep into them, you will find the Eastern religious person who can believe in anything. Gullible. A believer. You will not find real logic. All logic will be just superficial. As far as their work is concerned, they will be logical. But as far as their life is concerned, you will say going them to the palmist or to the astrologer. If their son is getting married, they will not bother about any scientific approach towards it. They will go to the astrologer to inquire whether the marriage will succeed or not, whether they will be happy or not. Now a scientific person should go to the scientist to inquire whether their blood specimens meet, whether their hormones go together. He should ask a computer. A computer should be fed about all the information about both the persons. And the computer should bring it out, what is going to be the outcome out of these two persons meeting. Will they suit to each other? That will be more scientific, rather than going to an astrologer who will look at their birth chart and who will think about the stars and who will decide according to the stars. And this scientist will never look what is happening to the astrologer himself, just look at him and his wife. They are killing each other. The Eastern mind is basically non-scientific. One can learn science, but to be a scientist needs a totally different spirit. So happens in the West, the Western person can become religious, can learn, can come to the East, can become religious, but deep down the scientific approach persists. He goes on being logical. Sometimes it happens that books are written about Zen. Zen is an illogical approach, absurd approach, fundamentally Eastern. And in the West, books are written about Zen, explaining the illogic in a logical way. Trying to find out what is the logic of this illogicalness. There must be some logic in it. They are trying to find explanations. And they find out. When you insist, you can always find. You can fill the gaps. You can see things which are not there. Zen is simply illogical. There is no logic in it. But if you read Western books written on Zen, there is logic. They may say that Zen is illogical, but then immediately they will explain why. They will always try to bring things to reason. Rationalization is the Western approach. Irrational is the Eastern. So it is possible we can train some Indian to be a group leader. But he will be just a phony group leader. He will not be able to go deep into it. And he will not be able authentically to be there. Something is missing. And moreover, there are many who would like, out of curiosity, they go on again and again asking that why we Indians are not allowed. I can allow you. You will be simply disturbed. You will come out of it shaken, completely shaken. And the more possibility is, you will escape from me. And you will never come back again. Because you will not be able to figure it out, what is this? You cannot relate it with religion at all. Now somebody is being angry and beating the pillow or beating the wall and getting mad. Now the Indian will sit there and will say, what is going on? And what is the point of it all? How this man is going to become meditative by being mad? These things have to be dropped. And for these things to come to a group and pay for it, one can do these things at home. And how this man is going to be held by being so angry, so aggressive, so violent? The Indian cannot understand it, because the Indian has not suffered 2000 years of Christianity. He does not know what Christianity has done to the West. 2000 years of repression. That repression has gathered in the pit of the stomach. It is heavy there. It has not been allowed. Everything has been forced. When Vivek came here for the first time, she was not even able to burp. Repressed. Absolutely repressed. Burping is a beautiful thing. But in the West, you don't burp. From the very childhood, a child has to be taught, don't burp. What nonsense. In the East, we have a total different concept. If you go, if you are invited to a feast at somebody's house and you don't burp, that is insulting. That means you are not satisfied. In my childhood, I used to go with my father. He is a great burper. And whenever he will go to somebody else's house, he will burp loudly. And I asked him, why you do that much? You don't never do that much at home. He said, it has to be done. Otherwise, the people will think that we are not satisfied. The burp gives a satisfactory expression. It says the stomach is full. And I am perfectly satisfied and I am happy. It is a physical expression. I was reading one of Janot's books in which he gives two certificates from his patients who have been helped by primal therapy. There is one certificate, one man says, that I am very, very thankful to you, because in my life for the first time after primal therapy I began to burp. And the man says, it is amazing. I also say it is amazing. Primal therapy is needed to help you to burp. Such a depression. You don't know what calamity has happened to the Western mind. Everything has been forced. You have to be loving and love has disappeared. You have not to be angry and anger has gone deep into the pit of the stomach. It is there, solid like rock. You have to go on smiling. You have to show a face to everybody. This is the etiquette. Falsity, phoniness has been taught. That phoniness has to be dropped before one can enter into meditation. Now, for the Eastern, there is not such a problem. Phoniness has never been taught. So it is very difficult. If I send an Indian to the group, he may even start being phony, trying to be angry. Because he will say, everybody is doing that, so it has to be done. he will move to the other extreme, because it has to be done, because everybody is doing and they are being helped and they are growing and they are enjoying it and they are feeling so ecstatic. I am missing something, so he will start doing it. He will be simply tired, exhausted. He will come out of it simply feeling spent, not expended. That's why I have not allowed. And then he will go and start creating rumors all around. That is one of the basic curiosities. Again and again Indians ask, why you are not allowing us? Their curiosity is so they can see what is happening there. If somebody becomes nude, that will be something. The Indian will enjoy that much more than anything else. And he will go and spread the news all over and exaggerate as much as he can. In that, they are perfect masters. And will create trouble for the groups, that's all. The last thing, the West is how oriented, the East is why oriented. How means methodology, technique. Why means no method, no technique, no effort. West is effort oriented, East is effortlessness. The whole approach of the East is how to relax, to know. The Western approach is how to strain, concentrate, to know. How to be more attentive, to know. The East is how to be so relaxed that there is nothing. A sort of euphoria, no concentration, a sort of vagueness, a cloudiness, where boundaries disappear and distinctions are no more valid, where each thing meets and merges into each other thing. When all boundaries are blurred, in that vague, wide, distinctionless clouds, one comes to know. Methods are to clarify. The West has no vision of the why, and the East has no provision for the how. But now things are getting mixed up. East is no more East, West is no more West. People are traveling, people are being educated here and there. People are coming to learn religion to the East, people are going to learn science to the West. Everything is meeting and merging. You must have heard the famous lines of Rudyard Kipling. West is West, East is East, and the twain shall never meet. They are meeting. In the days of Kipling, it was almost certain that they shall never meet. They are meeting. Things change. That which cannot be conceived becomes conceivable. East and West are meeting. There is only one problem and only one fear, that Rudyard Kipling may prove right from the other side. The problem is the West may become so much Eastern and the East may become so much Western, again they may not meet. That is the only problem. The East may become West, the West may become East and the twin cell never meets. That is possible. That's why you see there are not many Eastern people here. Because I am saying something, East is no more interested in it. You will find more Eastern students in the Harvard. You will find more Eastern students in the Oxford, sitting in the feet of a scientist, learning from a scientist. You will not find so many Eastern people sitting in the feet of a mystic and learning about meditation. You will find Western people rushing. A great pilgrimage has started. You are coming from the West, dropping out of the Oxfords and the Cambridges and the Harvards in search of an inner space. And the Eastern young man is rushing towards the West to know more about technology, engineering, chemistry, physics, mathematics. There is a danger. It happened once. In a town there was a great atheist and there was also a great theist. Both were great. And the whole town was disturbed and puzzled. It was a small town. And the atheist will prove to everybody that there is no God. And his arguments were superb. And the theist will prove that there is a God, and his arguments were also superb. And the village was in a very difficult situation, what to decide. The whole village was confused. And 24 hours, day in, day out, these two persons were contradicting each other. And the whole village came to a point where they started feeling they will go mad. And both the arguments were so superb. It was difficult to decide. They were almost equal. They negated each other, but then the people were left with a vacuum. So the village decided, just to save their sanity, they decided we should ask these two persons to have a great debate and convince each other. Either the atheist becomes a theist or the theist becomes an atheist. And whatsoever they decide between these two, we will follow. But this has to be decided. Enough of indecision. So a great debate was arranged. And the atheist proved that there is no God. And the theist proved that there is God. And by the morning, a strange thing happened. The theist became convinced that there is no God, and the atheist became convinced that there is God, and the problem remained the same, and the village is still in confusion. That is possible. The West may become East, the East may become West, and again the same polarity. This has to be avoided. For the first time, it has become feasible to create a one world. For the first time, it is practically possible to create one earth. For the first time, it is possible to drop the concepts of East and West and create a new third psychology. I call the psychology of the Buddhas. I am trying that. But I have to look to your past. The whole goal here is to create a meditative space. How it can be created, that is irrelevant. If you need group processes, I will give you group processes. But the meditative space has to be created. If you don't need group processes, you need simple meditations, I will give you simple meditations. But the meditative space has to be created. Only in that meditative space, the East and West will disappear. The Eastern and the Western psychology will disappear. The division will disappear. A great experiment is on foot. You may not be aware how fortunate you are. You may not be aware that something of tremendous import is happening here. Something which can become the door of a great synthesis. A great Tao can arise. We can attain to the primordial unity. The groups are meant to destroy the Western psychology. And the simple meditative techniques are meant to destroy the Eastern psychology. When both are dropped, then you are human, neither Eastern nor Western. In fact, then you are just existential, with no mind. That no mind is the goal. The third question, I have decided to take sannyas, although I don't know for what reason I am doing it. Can you throw some light on it? If you have decided, then what is the point of knowing the reason? If you have already decided to take sannyas, then why this hankering to know the reason? Has there always been to be a reason for everything you do? Is it really needed? Have you done everything in your life because of certain reasons? This is again the Western mind, the Western psychology. A reason has to be there. Otherwise, why? Otherwise, why you should take it? Can't you take any step without any reason? If you cannot take, then you will never be able to live. Because life is irrational. It has no reason. Why you are here at all? Can you show any reason why you are here at all? Why you were born? Why you breathe? Why you love? Why you are happy? Why you are sad? For what? Because of this why, this constant hankering to know the reason, the West has become very suicidal. The problem arises, why to live at all? What is the reason? When you feel that there is no reason to live, then why not commit suicide? But I must tell you, there was a great Greek philosopher, Zeno. He used to teach to his people that there is no reason to live. But he lived to a very long age, 89 years. He lived long. And it is said that many people committed suicide because of his teaching. Because he was saying there is no reason why you are going on living. Every morning getting up, again going to bed, again getting up. For what? He puzzled many people. If you really ask deeply why, there is no why. You will be left only with a very uneasy space within you. Why? So he was a great scholar and a great logician. He proved people that there is no reason. Somebody asked him, but why you go on living? He said, I have to live because to teach people that there is no reason to live. This is my reason. When he was dying, 89, somebody asked on his deathbed that this is very puzzling and confusing that you lived so long. And for at least 50 years you have been teaching that there is no reason. He said, that's true. But I could not find the reason to commit suicide either. For what? Now look at this man. His life must have been a tremendous misery. You have no reason to live. You don't have any reason to die. I have heard a young man approached an old Jew. He was in love with the old Jew's daughter. He said to the old man, "Sir, I want to get married to your daughter." The old man looked at him, and as Jews are prone to ask, he said, "But young man, what are your reasons? Why do you want to get married to my daughter?" The young man shrugged his shoulders and said, "No reasons at all, sir. I am in love." No reasons at all. I am in love. Love needs no reason. Sannyas should be a love affair. You should not ask for reasons. Otherwise, sannyas will become very mundane. You go to the market, you purchase something, certainly there must be a reason. It is a commodity. You go to the market to purchase a car, there must be some reason. You need it. It is a utility. But you fall in love with a woman or a man, there is no utility. What utility love has? What use love has? You look at a rose flower and you are thrilled. What is the reason of being thrilled? What is there? You look at the moon and something in you simply gets connected with it. Something starts changing in your being. You feel a coolness. What is the reason? If you look for the reason, you will destroy all beauty, love, truth, God, meditation, everything. Please leave few things in life which have no reasons. Let sannyas be one of those few things. But I understand the Western urge to make everything rational, to find a reason for every act. Otherwise you will feel uneasy. So you can find some rationalization. Reason there is none. Rationalization you can find. You can invent. Why be bothered to ask me? You can invent some rationalization. Because you want to search truth. Because you want to go in search of God. Because you want to attain to your self-realization, or you want to become enlightened. All excuses, all rationalizations. A stranger stopped at Mullah Nasruddin's store for cigarettes. On the wall was a sign, "This store will be closed August 28th on account of the weather." As it was only August 15th, the man asked the Mullah how could he know what the weather would be so far in advance. "Well," said Nasruddin, "if it rains light, I am going fishing. If it rains heavy, I am going to stay home and work on my tackles." "But how do you know it is going to rain?" asked the man. "Don't care if it rains or not," explained Nasruddin. "If it is sunny, I will go fishing or work on my tackle anyway. All depends on the weather." Now you can find something. All depends on the weather. You can find some rationalization, some excuse. If you have decided, let this decision be pure. uncorrupted by any reason. Look at the beauty of it, what I am saying. If you can do something without any reason, that means you have done something without the mind coming in. If you can do something without reason, that means you have done something out of no mind. If you can do something without reason, that means something has happened, you have not done it. Let sannyas be a happening. Why bother about reasons? You must have fallen in love with my orange people. You must have fallen in love with me. You must have fallen in love with the space that is being created here. Let it be a love affair. Don't bring reason in. And then your sannyas will go deeper. It can go very deep. It can transform you. With the reason, it will be superficial. It is for you to choose. If you want some reason, you can find. But my feeling is, be courageous sometimes to do something which has no reason at all. You could have avoided it. You could have managed not to do it, but still you allowed it to happen. Let something bigger than you happen to you. You cannot figure it out what it is. Going into that unknown is sannyas. Going into that unfamiliar, uncharted is sannyas. Going into that without making arrangements where you are going, for what, just going as if pulled in by some greater power than you, is sannyas. The fifth question: does the man of Tao like to taste many women, or does he stay with one until he is able to eat the master? For the man of Tao, first thing, there is not many in one. For the man of Tao, all women are one woman. Because the man of Tao looks at the energy and not at the form. For the man of Tao, one woman is different from another woman only because of the frame. The sky is the same. For the man of Tao, there is feminine energy and masculine energy, yin and yang. Whether you stand on one window and look at the sky, or you stand on another window and look at the same sky, makes no difference. First thing, all women are one women because there is only one feminine energy. It is one sky framed in different windows. First thing. Second thing, for the man of Tao, one woman is all woman. Because when you look from a window into the sky, if you are not too much obsessed with the frame, it is the same sky. It is one sky. So one woman is all women, and all women are one woman for the man of Tao, because the man of Tao thinks in terms, contemplates in terms of energies, not in forms. He thinks in terms of the formless. When I look into you, I am not bothered at all by the frame you exist in. I look at the painting, I don't look at the frame. The frames differ, but the painting is the same. It is the one God, the same, one sky. And for the man of Tao, in fact, the man and the woman also by and by start disappearing. There is only one energy. Call it X by Z. Tao is, call it Tao. It means nothing. It means X. There is only one energy, Tao. It functions in two ways, man and woman. It is the same energy. It has to create a polarity to function. Otherwise, it will not be able to function at all. These two of my hands are same energy. I am in both. But if I want to clap them, I can clap them. I can put them against each other. I can hit my right hand by my left. Or I can love my left hand by my right. Still, I am flowing in both the hands. I am Tao. The right hand is yang. The left hand is yin. You are Tao. The masculine is your right hand. The feminine is your left hand. Now, you can create either a clash between the two, or you can create a harmony between the two. But whether the clash or the harmony, the energy remains the same. A man who has attained to Tao has gone beyond man and woman. He is no more man and he is no more woman. He is Tao. The sixth question, and now for the bombshell. Lin Tzu never existed, right? Lin Tzu existed or not does not matter. Right or wrong. It does not matter at all. The Western scholars have been very much puzzled about Lin Tzu, whether he ever existed. And they write great treatises. And they work hard for years to find out whether this man really ever existed. To the Eastern mind, it looks stupid, this whole scholarship. Because it does not matter whether he existed or not. If you ask me whether he existed or not, I say it is all the same. Whosoever wrote these beautiful stories by Lin Tzu, whosoever. One thing is certain, somebody wrote these beautiful stories. That much is certain, these stories exist. Now, whether somebody really of the name of Lin Tzu wrote these stories, or somebody of some other name wrote them, how does it make any difference? It will not add anything to the stories. They are perfect. It will not take anything away from the stories. Nothing can be taken. Whether Lin Tzu was a historical person or not, how it is going to affect these stories? These stories are so beautiful. They have intrinsic value. One thing is certain, somebody wrote them. So why be bothered, what was his name? Lin Tzu or somebody else? It is possible they may be written by many people. Then too there is no problem. Whosoever wrote a story must have touched the consciousness of Tao. Otherwise these stories cannot be written. One man wrote or many. But whenever these stories were written, somebody has penetrated into the Tao consciousness. Somebody has understood what life is. Somebody has had a vision. In the West, this is very significant. People go on writing books and books whether Shakespeare ever existed or not. As if it makes any difference. The plays that Shakespeare wrote are so beautiful. Why not look into the plays and love the plays and enjoy the plays? This seems to be just going astray. Whether Shakespeare existed or not. And the problem arises because it is thought that Shakespeare was an uneducated man. So how can he write such beautiful things? Have you ever known very educated men writing beautiful things? It is thought that it is not Shakespeare but Lord Bacon who was the real author. But I cannot trust this because I have read Lord Bacon's other books. They have nothing to compare with Shakespeare. He is just ordinary. He may have been a very learned man. He must have been a great scholar. But his books are ordinary, rubbish. Just because he is Lord Bacon and a very famous name, who is deceived? Have you ever heard any name of any book of Lord Bacon? Who is bothered? How Lord Bacon can write these Shakespearean plays? Under his own name he has not written single masterpiece. So how can he write under a pseudonym? And if he can write under a pseudonym such beautiful plays as Shakespearean plays are, then what he was doing when he was writing under his own name? It doesn't seem right. So whether Shakespeare was known as Shakespeare or not, that's not the point. Some consciousness certainly existed who has given birth to these beautiful plays. What is wrong in calling that consciousness Shakespeare? The same is true about Li Dazu. There is suspicion. It has never been in the East. We have never bothered. In India, we have many books written by one man, Vyasa. The Mahabharata is enough to write the book like Mahabharata is enough for one author. It is Encyclopedia Britannica. It will make one man famous for ages to come. But that is only one of the books that he has written. And there are hundreds of books in his name. Now the Western scholarship cannot believe one man can write so many books. I can understand. It seems not possible. And then these books are not written in one age. One book 5,000 years before, another book 3,000 years before, another book 2,000 years before. So this man existed for 1,000 years. But in the East we have never worried about it. Can't we see the problem? We can also see the problem. But our approach is different. We say, what does it matter? Who wrote them? The books are beautiful. The books are so beautiful, so tremendously significant. We have enjoyed them down the centuries. We have loved them. We have contemplated over them. The authorship is irrelevant. And why one man In fact, the case is this. Once Vyasa's name became famous, then other authors simply did not bother to put their own name. They said, it will do. Vyasa's name is good and is a well-known name. It will do. So down the centuries, anybody who wrote a beautiful book and thought that it is worthy of a Vyasa, he signed it Vyasa. It is worthy of the man who wrote Mahabharata. So how can I sign in my own name? That will not look right. In fact, only Vyasa can write it. It is so beautiful. So he signed it in the name of Vyasa. Beautiful were these people, with no egos of their own. And they were just vehicles. In fact, later on, the name Vyasa became just synonymous with the author. Vyasa now means the author, written by the author. It doesn't mean anything else. In the East, we know when some book is written by Vyasa, it means written by the author. Naturally, every book has to be written by the author. Vyasa became synonymous with the author. Ling Tzu is suspicious. Does not seem to be a historical person at all. Has not left any trace. Either he was not a historical person or he was a great horse. My preference is for the second. He was a great horse who never raises dust and who never leaves any track behind. Effaced himself completely. Only this small book exists, the book of Lithas, with these small parables. It says nothing about Lithas. But why one should bother? This is going into the non-essential. This is looking at the color of the heart. The color of the heart was black. And the man of Tao reported it is yellow. And the heart was a stallion. And the man reported it is a mare. Li Tzu may have been a woman, may not have been a man. Who knows? He may not have been a Chinese, may have been a Tibetan, who knows? He may not have been at all, does not matter. But these parables matter. These parables are doors. So please, don't go into the non-essential. Look into the spirit of the essential. Don't be bothered by the grass. Go into the subtle. The seventh question, the earth seems to be shaking beneath our feet and our faces reflect some imminent cataclysmic event. What is happening? Don't be worried. It has been always so. Every age and every generation has thought that something great is happening. Because every generation has a great ego. And how it is possible that something great is not happening while you are here? No. Something cataclysmic, something great, something really final is going to happen. This has been so from the very beginning. I have heard that when Adam and Eve was thrown out, expelled out of the Garden of Eden, the first thing that Adam said to Eve was, "Darling, we are passing through a great revolution." Since then, man has always felt the same, again and again and again, down the ages. It is nothing new. A stone has been found in Babylon, 6,000 years old, with four or five sentences. inscribed on it. When those sentences were deciphered, people were puzzled. If you read those sentences, you will not believe that they are 6,000 years old. They look as if they are part of the editorial of today's Pune Herald. The first thing that inscription says, where are the old golden days? The new generation has become very corrupted. Children don't respect their parents. 6,000 years old. It has not used the word hippie, right? But what is the difference? Children don't obey their parents. There is no respect left. Love has disappeared. Wives don't love their husbands, husbands don't love their wives. It is the most immoral age ever. These are the sentences. The most immoral age, but the ego feels satisfied. Our age is the most immoral age. Nobody can compete. Nobody can be compared. And always every age has felt that we are passing through a very critical moment. Sir, it has been always so. You don't be worried. You rest and go to sleep. Let the earth shake. It has been always shaking. It is nothing new. On the earth, everything is almost old and ancient. There is a saying in India that there is nothing new under the sun. And in a way, it is very significant. Only forms differ. Everything is the same. The same anger, the same hatred, the same war, the same violence, the same inhumanity. The same madness, the same neurosis. Nothing is new under the sun. And you don't waste time about it. You just go within yourself and find that which is eternal. Find out that which is your reality. These outer things have remained the same way, changing a little bit here and there, but basically repeating the same gestalt. The politics, the politicians, the war amongst nations, and the religions, and the churches, and their violent struggle to survive and crush each other. The greed of man, and the aggressiveness of man, and the inhumanity of man towards other human beings. The last question, Bhagwan, please summarize what is the ego? An egoistical lover met a girl in a drug store and asked her, how would you like to go out sleeping with me tonight, baby? The girl, insulted and angry, used her knowledge of judo and swung him out of the door. Jolted and jilted, the egotistical lover returned, but baby, he said, you have not answered my question. That's what ego is. The greatest stupidity. You can't see it because you are it. You can always see it in others. You cannot see it in yourself. A Jew became suddenly very rich. Now he wanted to show to people. So they went to the costliest restaurant. In the costliest dresses they were, he and his wife. And the wife was wearing diamonds and emeralds and all that they could purchase, and they had really become rich. She was looking very ugly with those all diamonds and all those emeralds, because there was no taste. You can become rich suddenly, but you cannot gain taste suddenly. You can become rich suddenly, but you cannot become cultured suddenly. And sometimes, when you become suddenly rich, all your ugliness comes to the surface. You purchase all that ugliness by your richness. You can afford it now. Up to now it was hidden, now it comes to the surface. They sat in the restaurant, they looked at the menu, but the menu was in French. They could not read. They didn't know anything about French. And they did not want to say to the bearer that we don't know French. So the wife asked, "What are you going to order now?" He said, "Don't be worried." He said, "Bring me $100 worth salami. $100 worth. The ego is just absurd. Asking for salami sandwiches for $100 worth, the waiter could not believe. He said, "You both are going to eat it?" But it is difficult to look at your own. Ego is something that everybody is aware, only you are not aware. Whenever others say something about you, ponder over it. Meditate over it. There is every possibility they will be right. When others say anything about your ego, don't deny it, don't reject it. There is every possibility they will be right. 99% the possibility is they are right, because others can very easily see your ego. You cannot see. You can see others' egos very easily. It is there just exactly on the tip of their nose. In everything they do, walking, sitting, talking, listening, it is there. It is so apparent, so obvious to everybody, except to the person himself. He hides behind it. The actors were out of work when they met in Lindy's one day. "Say, I got an idea," said one. "Why don't we team up? Do an act together." "Sounds good," said the other. "What kind of an act have you got in mind?" "Well, I'll come out and sing. The curtain comes down. Then it goes up and I come out and dance. Then the curtain comes down. Then it goes up again and I come out and juggle. Then, hey, where do I come in? The curtain don't go up and down by itself." That's what ego is. You are the emperor and everybody is a servant. You are the end and everybody is a means. This is the basic ingredient of the ego, the very center. that you are the center of whole existence and everybody is here to serve you, to be used by you. If you are using people, you are an egoist. If you think yourself as the center and everybody else is your periphery, then you are an egoist. If you think everybody is an end unto himself, then ego starts disappearing. If you don't put yourself higher than others or lower than others, then ego disappears. Remember, you know, to put higher than others is to be egoistical, but I am saying to put lower than others, that too is egoistical. That is ego standing on its head, but it is ego all the same. So don't put anybody higher than you, don't put anybody lower than you. We are one. We are one existence. Nobody is lower, nobody is higher. Nobody is superior, nobody is inferior. There are not two gods, so how there can be inferiority, superiority? It is one unity. Ego makes you feel separate. Non-ego joins you with existence. To feel one with the cosmos is to get out of the ego. To feel separate is to be in the ego. And ego is what Tao is not. And Tao is what ego is not. If you are in the ego, you will never taste Tao. If you want to taste Tao, you will have to drop the ego. Dropping it, you come home. Dropping it, the benediction. Enough for today.